in Genesis chapter 2, starting at verse 4. Before we just jump into the text, we need to explain what's going on, because in Genesis chapter 1 was an overview. It went through the first 6 days of creation. And then in here at Genesis chapter 2, starting at verse 4, it starts a slightly different emphasis. It opens with an opening, and some, especially the form critics, have said, look, in chapter 1, it moves at a high level, it moves quickly. In chapter 2, it slows down, it seems to have another introduction. It has raised questions of some people, are there two different accounts, one in Genesis 1 and another in Genesis 2? I don't think so. I think it's merely what God wanted us to hear, which was to slow down and emphasize some of the things that happened on the creation day 6. That's what we have here in this. This next section is going to slow down a little bit, and it's going to give us more detail of what happened between Adam and the animals and things like that. Any comments on that, Steve, before we jump in and read?
Because there is a style of writing doesn't mean that there is a different author. An example of that is there's a style of writing where the author will mention of something that's happening in the present, and then as it goes to another chapter, he'll mention of something that's happening in the past. That is a particular style of writing. Now, that doesn't mean that there's two different authors that are writing that particular book.
In Genesis 2, we have the account of the origin of mankind. We are introduced to Eve. Adam has a job. And then there's how men and women relate to each other. All that's here in chapter 2. It's very important. Steve, if you could start at Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, and read down to verse 8.
This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that the Lord God made earth and heaven. Now no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprouted, for the Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to cultivate the ground. But a mist used to rise from the earth and water the whole surface of the ground. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. The Lord God planted a garden toward the east in Eden, and there he placed the man whom he had formed.
With this, we have God placing the man in the garden. Verse 5 tells us that there were no plants in the field because there was no man to cultivate the ground. The perspective here was growing food. That's the assumption here, is there's no man out there to cultivate the field to grow food. Since there were no humans, there was no food being grown. That's the emphasis here in verse 5. It also tells us at this time there was no rain. It tells us this account was written years later. Traditionally, it's always been Moses that created this, who wrote the account of the Pentateuch, first five books, with God's divine revelation. With this, there's no rain, but there's a foreshadowing of rain, simply because it says in those days there was no rain, but there's this mist. With all that, Steve, the emphasis is in verse 7. Who does it tell us made mankind?
The Lord God formed man. The Lord there is in all caps, so that means that behind that word is Yahweh, YHWH. And so it's Yahweh, the creator, made man.
That's the emphasis here. The emphasis is that God made mankind. What does it say he made us out of?
He made us out of the dust of the earth.
The dust of the earth. In chapter 3, verse 19 says, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. With that, we get some of the phrases they'll say at funerals or memorial services, from dust to dust. Our modern chemistry and our modern biology tell us that in humans are the same basic elements that are in all of the earth. Here it uses the word dust, but it ends up being true. Our modern science tells us we are made of the dust of the earth. Is there anything in us that's special?
It says that he breathed into us and we became a living soul or a living being. So yeah, we have the breath or the spirit of God that makes us different from other animals.
That's what exactly makes us different. Other than the image of God and the breath of God, we're just a pile of elements. We're just a pile of dust. We're really no different than the pile of dirt out back of the building, other than God formed us. He arranged us in a certain way and put his image in us and breathed life into us. Otherwise, there's nothing special. Because he did all those things, that's what makes us special, is we're in the image of God and he breathed life into us. That's what makes us special. So we can't have any bragging rights, Steve. There's nothing in us that would hold me to be anything special other than what God did in my life. Then in verse 7, it says, God made man out of the dust of the ground, then did what? What does it say he did?
He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being.
The Lord God formed us out of the dust of the earth and breathed life into us. He's the one that gives us life. He is the source of life. This is what the emphasis here way back in Genesis is, that the source of life is the Lord God. Now, the other thing I think of here, Steve, is when it says here he breathed life into us. You remember there's a passage at the end of the Gospel of John, chapter 20, verse 22. Jesus takes the disciples. This is after the resurrection. In John 20, 22, it says he breathed on them and he told them, receive the Spirit. This, I think, was symbolic because they really didn't change at that point until the day of Pentecost. They weren't really renewed with power until Acts chapter 2. But nevertheless, here in Genesis chapter 2, God breathed life into them after Jesus' resurrection, starting the next creation, the new covenant. Jesus breathed on the disciples. And I found that to be kind of profound. The idea of God's breath is a sign or a symbol of life. There's another place I think of, if you remember in Ezekiel, I believe it's chapter 37, the story of the Valley of the Dry Bones. And God showed Ezekiel this valley full of bones. And it says, indeed, they were very dry. God told Ezekiel, prophesy over the bones. And the bones started coming together and they had flesh on them, but they didn't have life until he breathed into them. Of course, that was a prophecy of the return of Israel when they'd been scattered and as a nation had died. God's going to bring them back and breathe life into them. This idea of where does our life come from, both as individuals, as Christians, as nations, where does our life come from? It comes from the Lord God.
Our life, our sustenance, everything that we have, our salvation, all of that comes from the Lord God. There's a lot of things that we are dependent on, we take for granted many times, or at least a lot of people do. When you become a Christian, you begin to realize some of this. You know, Glenn, you mentioned the parallel there between the breath mentioned here in Genesis and the breath mentioned over in John. We see a lot of those parallels that have meanings that some people just read past. But what you described there is something that really, to me, gave a meaning to what God did. He breathed, gave him the Spirit, but it comes back here, I think, as you pointed out.
He breathed life into man here in Genesis 2. And that tells us that God is the source of life, and we are with him, we have life. When we are apart from him, we have death. In the next chapter, chapter 3, we're going to see death is introduced because Adam's going to sin. And at that point, he says, in the day you eat of the fruit, you'll die. We have this contrast between God giving them life, and then in the next chapter, Adam frittering it away and ending up in death. Very clear teaching here. God is the source of life. Then the other thing in verse 8, Steve, what does it say in verse 8 that God did?
He put a garden there called Eden, then he planted man there, or he put Adam there in that garden. The garden was made for him, and he put him there.
Then the very next verse, in verse 9, what else did he put in the garden?
It says that it caused every tree to grow and that was pleasing in sight, that was good for food. And there was also the tree of life there.
God makes this garden. He puts Adam in the garden. It's full of good things. It's full of all these trees that produce all this kind of food. You don't have to go work for the food. And it tells them that it's a very good place. That's the image here. It's unspoiled. It's pure. It's full of life. God and man has fellowship here. That's key. We can't lose that because the next chapter is going to start a lot of problems.
Now, it also says there in verse 9 that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was also there. As the story progresses, we're going to see where this tree of the knowledge of good and evil comes into play. But we see in this verse that the tree of life was there at the same time that this tree of the knowledge of good and evil was there.
Look again at verse 9. It says, out of the ground, the Lord God caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. To me, that says that God is not only the creator, but he's the provider. He makes things that look good. He makes things that are good. It's good for you and nourishing, but it's also, God's a God of beauty. He makes things that are beautiful to look at. This was a very, very good place. God is a provider. He provided Adam a garden that was pleasing to the eyes and pleasing to the body. Does God still provide for us today?
He absolutely does. The earth that we have and everything about it, what he structured from and the way that he structured it from the very beginning shows that he is not only a provider, but he set it up in such a way that it could sustain us and provide things for us, just unbelievable amounts of fish and fowl and things that can be produced so that we can have a continued sustenance here on earth. It's, to me, it's just a miraculous thing, which it really basically is.
Well, I would agree. He provides great things. But Steve, there's been times in my life where I was pretty needy. And I'm sure there's people in our audience now that have a myriad of needs. Does God say that he's going to provide everything that our heart could ever desire? Or what is he really saying here as far as what is he going to provide?
I think that he's saying here that he's going to provide what it is that we need in order to live. We have a lot of superfluous things that come about from what we, our heart's desire, as you put it, a lot of extra stuff that we actually don't really need to live on or by. God is wise in that way, and he has just provided for us what we need, not necessarily what we want.
The other thing that's different today is that we are on the other side of Genesis chapter 3, where the problem occurs. God created the garden as a beautiful place that was beautiful to the eyes, good for food, and it produced a lot of things. It was a perfect world, and God is our provider. Even in a sinful, fallen world, he will give us what we need. He will not necessarily give us all that our sinful heart desires. That, I think, is one of the messages here, is God is the provider. The other thing, to just a side note here in verse 8, is it says here the garden was toward the east in Eden. Technically, according to what it says, the garden was in Eden. It's not that the Eden was the garden. There was a land called Eden, and in this Eden was this garden. That's where he put man. The garden was a primary focal point, and it's where we get the term Garden of Eden. But technically, it's saying there is that in the east, in Eden, is where the garden was. The pure state here of fellowship with God was in the garden. Don't miss the point. It is a perfect garden that God provided. There's no sin yet. There's no problems. Everything is all good and beautiful. So let's go ahead and read the next section, starting in verse 9 and going down through 14, says this. Out of the ground, the Lord God caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it divided and became four rivers. The name of the first is Pishon. It flows around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. The gold of that land is good. The Delium and the onyx stone are there. The name of the second river is Gihon. It flows around the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is Tigris. It flows east of Assyria. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. We have this detail here, Steve. It's a geography lesson about the land of Eden and where the garden was. Verse 9 talks of this tree of life. And the book of Proverbs speaks metaphorically about a tree of life. It says that a handful of times. But the actual tree of life is not mentioned again until Revelation, that talks about the tree of life being in the midst of paradise where we have fellowship with God. As I think we mentioned in our previous session, Steve, it's clearly making bookends on the Bible. There's the garden, which is pure. It's where he made light. in the last couple of chapters of Revelation, there's no night there. And here there's this garden with all these minerals and gold, and it's very pure. And there's rivers there with, you know, river is a sign of water and water is life. We see the same thing again over in Revelation. And it has beautiful stones here in the garden. And it has beautiful stones in the new heavens and the new earth. Very clearly bookends. Talks about the tree of life here. And it also talks about the tree of life at the end of Revelation. And other than those couple of metaphorical mentions in Proverbs, the tree of life really isn't mentioned except in these bookends at the beginning and the ends of the Bible. That tells me the Bible is a very designed book. It was written by God through humans, and there's 66 books written by a double handful of people, but it's all one message. Now, moving on here, in verse 10 through 14, it mentions these four rivers. Two of them we know about, the Tigris and the Euphrates. The other names in the lands have been lost. One of the lands, Havilah, is mentioned in 1 Samuel 15. But from this, when I read this section, to me, it doesn't read like a parable. It doesn't read like an allegory. It's a geography lesson. It tells us where these rivers are, how many of them there are, the names of the rivers, what kind of minerals are there, and the quality of the minerals. To me, Steve, that just doesn't read like an allegory. It reads like a literal geography lesson. I think those of us that would make our Christian brothers and sisters that make the entire three or four chapters, or some people even make the entire first 11 chapters of Genesis as all some sort of a literary device. I think we have an issue here with these rivers.
Yeah, I don't know how you can make these rivers into a literary device and make some type of allegory out of them. It seems to me that you'd have to go out of your way in order to spiritualize these rivers. They're very specific. If you were going to use them, I think, as a allegory, you would just have river names. You wouldn't have all the different descriptive features about them.
I think people go out of their way to deny a lot of things. Nevertheless, what we have here, I think, is a clear parallel. As you mentioned before, there's rivers, there's gold, there's all these minerals. It's the perfect world. Steve, if you could start at verse 15 and read down through verse 18.
Then the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it. The Lord God commanded the man, saying, "From any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat from it, you will surely die." Then the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him."
Here God gives Adam, or the man, he gives him a job. What was the man to do? What was his job?
He was to cultivate the garden and to take care of it.
Cultivate the garden and take care of it. Make note here, this is before the fall. He gives them meaningful work to do. This tells me, Steve, that work is not a curse of sin. It's not a problem that we have to do. Work is a blessing. Work is a good thing. It's before the fall. He gives them something productive to do. It's later what he tells them is that the work's going to be hard now. And here, but just the fact that there's work, it's a good thing. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. We're told in the millennial kingdom, that 1,000-year period of God's kingdom, Jesus's kingdom here on earth, it's not just going to be us sitting around. We're going to have things to do in that millennial kingdom.
That's an excellent point. In heaven, in the millennium, there's work to do. In the new heavens and the new earth, we're not going to be sitting on a cloud playing a harp. Why do we sometimes today view work as a curse?
I think it's just something that is in people that I have to go out and make a living. And some people actually enjoy the jobs that they have, and other people don't enjoy the jobs that they have. But they look at it as being something that's a obstacle, maybe, of what they want to have and where they want to go. Others look at it as a burden that they actually have to get up and go and do something every day rather than doing what they want to do. I think there's a myriad of reasons why people look at it as being a curse.
I think one of those reasons, primary reason, we're going to get to in the next chapter, in Genesis chapter 3, specifically verses 17 and 18, we are introduced to a problem, which is called sin. And with sin, God puts a curse on the ground, and it makes it difficult to produce food and difficult to get things done. That's when it becomes a problem. Here, prior to the fall, work is a blessing. I think after the fall, it's things like work are marred, but they're not erased. Work is still, I think, a good thing. Gives us a sense of productivity. We can accomplish things by working with our own hands or with our own mind. We should view work as a blessing and a ministry. God puts us into our jobs, our employment, to do His will and to do things for Him. And I think just like Adam, He'll give us meaningful things to do. And I think, Steve, here we probably ought to pause simply because next time we're going to get to the first command in the Bible. He gives them one thing. He gives them one thing to do. And we're going to find out how good of a job he is doing that one thing.
It's always that one thing that messes us up. Thank you so much for watching and listening. Join us again next time. May God bless you.